Money FM 89.3, best of prime time. Market View on Money FM 89.3.
You're with Bharati Jagdish and Timothy Goa on Prime Time. Time now for Market View, and high fuel prices are dominating today. They are a major challenge for all of us. Experts say this should remind us of the need to invest in cleaner, more sustainable and more efficient technologies. In the last few years, new energy and climate policy commitments from governments in this region in Southeast Asia have been notable, but the situation has been complicated by uncertainties, such as, of course, the COVID-19 pandemic. And don't forget, volatile prices made worse by Russia's invasion of Ukraine. So what's next for the region's energy sector? Is Southeast Asia on track to meet its sustainability goals? What do individual governments have to do in terms of policies to, firstly, reduce their reliance on fossil fuels, and then to achieve their net zero ambitions? To discuss this, Chief Energy Economist from the International Energy Agency, Tim Gold, joins me. Hi, Tim.
Hi there. Very pleased to join you today.
Thank you so much for joining us indeed. Now, Tim, at the recent launch of the 15th Singapore International Energy Week, which is going to be taking place from the 25th to the 28th of October, you released your report on Southeast Asia's energy outlook for this year. And in it, you acknowledge that the region's net zero ambitions are clear. But considering the status quo, Southeast Asia is not on track to meet its sustainability goals. What's the problem here?
I think you framed it very well. I think we have to have in mind that right now we're facing, in a way, a triple crisis. We have an energy crisis, we have a climate crisis, and we have a food crisis. Each of these is real. Each of these is tough. Southeast Asia is certainly vulnerable to all of these. It's extremely important that we don't have the solutions to one of these crises making the other problems worse. So, for example, I mean, you can burn more coal as a way to keep the lights on, but of course that's going to worsen your problems with climate change. And so the essence of our new analysis that we released the other day is to underline that there are cost-effective ways to respond to today's energy crisis that don't compromise our ability to tackle climate change. And as you mentioned, there's lots of positive signs, lots of commitments. But still, if you look back at the last 20 years, 90% of the growth in energy demand across Southeast Asia has been met by fossil fuels. And those fossil fuels are very expensive today. So we have to recognize that if the region had invested more in efficiency, more in clean electricity, more in low carbon fuels, we'd be in a better situation today. Now, that's not completely simple, but we think there are ways to move more resolutely in that direction.
Okay, so let's talk about some of those ways. And before we can do that, we need to figure out what's lacking in the approach at this point. So tell us what's lacking, and then we can discuss how to move forward more productively.
As you mentioned up front, a lot of this really comes down to investment. But the technologies that each part of the region is going to need to invest in, I mean, we don't have a single solution that works for everyone. There are different policy priorities, there are different national resources, there's different income levels and so on. So in some countries, there's still going to be a very strong focus on investing to improve energy access, not just for electricity, but also for access to clean cooking fuels. And then for us, it's clear efficiency and clean electricity. Those are the real like twin pillars of a sustainable approach in the near term. The technologies are mature. You just need to get the policy and regulatory frameworks right. And if you look at examples in this region and in other regions, then you will start to attract capital into some of those technologies.
Before we talk more about investments and capital, let's talk about policies in particular. I mean, for instance, today's contractual arrangements for coal and gas-fired plants offer no incentives for these plants to provide flexibility. This is something that you mentioned in your report as being one of the areas that will need to change. Also, today's policy settings imply continued strong reliance on fossil fuels to meet future demand and future growth. National and international public finance also will be essential in meeting the region's energy security. But you're saying governments also need to do more to attract private investors by reducing regulatory and financing risks. So it really comes down to policy. Tell us more about how you think governments can be moved to taking the necessary steps in this regard.
I think there are some well-known ways in which countries can bring money into new generation technologies such as solar PV and wind. I mean, and that requires having a policy vision. It requires offering a degree of visibility on the remuneration that those investments get. And it requires attention to some of the permitting issues around these investments. And there's a very uneven pattern of investment in those kinds of technologies across Southeast Asia. In fact, a very high proportion of the money that's been spent so far is really concentrated in just a handful of countries, notably in Vietnam. And so you do need to look at all of the issues that are holding that back. One of the things that we think is particularly important is to build up some common infrastructure to get that common ASEAN grid functioning even better. There are other contractual issues of the sorts that you mentioned. You know, some of the arrangements that have been made with existing fossil fuel fired power generators, they do create some obstacles to the rise of very cost competitive clean power. We're urging governments to take a look at that as well.
Now, some governments have also continued to subsidize the construction of power generating capacity based on fossil fuels. Some experts say that this, of course, arises from the long-standing role of fossil fuels in their economies and the powerful industrial interest groups that exist as well. How can something like that be overcome?
I think there will be a role for fossil fuels, particularly for natural gas in the region for many years to come. But there are competitive advantages for the move towards some clean energy technologies. And I think, you know, they are generating their own interest, their own momentum, and their own sort of investment wave. And we're certainly encouraging countries to look for cheap and competitive, but also clean solutions for the future.
You mentioned Vietnam earlier. What would you attribute Vietnam's success to in this arena?
Well, I think the Vietnamese government decided that there was an opportunity there, and they just put in place some of the policies that allowed for that influx of private capital. And they've certainly been very successful in bringing money into new solar generation. They also highlight, the Vietnamese experience also highlights how important it is to get all different parts of the puzzle together. So it's not just about generation, it's also about making sure that the grid is expanding to accommodate these new sources. But I think there's some very important lessons there for other countries in the region to look at and learn from.
Now, the funds required obviously are a big concern. And in the larger context, the amount of money that rich countries give to the developing world to help it cope with climate change was one of the big battles of the COP26 climate summit. How do you see this unfolding? To what extent do you think businesses will have to be the ones to make up for shortfalls?
Well, I think there's a couple of things there. Firstly, we do see that there's a sort of deficit in the amount of international climate finance coming through. And we're talking with governments and urging them to step up that help. But I think in the end, you also need to recognize that the capital requirements for an energy transition are going to be huge. You can't rely on public sources for that. You're going to need to create ways to bring in private capital. In our view, well over half of the capital that's required for energy transitions is going to have to come from private finance. But the public side can have a really important catalytic effect in improving the sort of risk-reward proposition for private sector investors.
Now, you yourself have acknowledged that there are strong country-by-country economic and energy variations. What is required right now in order to get everyone up to speed and to come to some sort of a harmonized arrangement where this ASEAN grid can come to fruition?
I mean, a lot of work is being done already, and I think it's extremely positive that the countries of ASEAN are really focused on finding common approaches to their common challenges. I mean, I think in terms of the grid, there's a number of ways in which the grid can develop. It's very important not just to get the investment in the infrastructure right, but also some more harmonized and common arrangements for cross-border trading. That might be bilateral at first, but eventually you're looking for some sort of multilateral arrangement, some sort of common understanding about the rules that can govern electricity trade across the wider region. But what we're also focused on in our own dialogue with ASEAN, which just celebrated 10 years of partnership with ASEAN, is not just on the, is to make sure that people recognize, you know, there are big advantages to having that broader space in which electricity can flow, because then you're taking advantage of the different regional strengths of different countries, and you're improving electricity security for everyone.
There are vast opportunities in this arena, aren't there? I mean, countries across the region are, for instance, well-placed to tap into the resources of bioenergy, hydrogen, as well as CO2 storage potential. We also have mineral resources and manufacturing abilities that could position the region well in terms of clean energy supply chains. Rapid growth in energy deployment will also create huge market opportunities. Are investors well aware enough of all of these things?
I think you'll find that there are plenty of investors that are looking actively at this. But one of the messages that we wanted to bring through with our own new analysis is that there are huge opportunities for countries and for companies that are ready to make the move into a new clean energy economy. And I think you see that in many parts of the region. And certainly, if I look at Singapore, there is this drive to become a regional center for energy innovation, and also, in a sense, for financial innovation, to bring capital to some of those new energy technologies. There is really a lot of private sector interest, not just in areas that are mature like solar, but also in some of the emerging technologies that we know that we're going to need for energy storage, for low-carbon hydrogen, for ways to make power grids smarter, for ways to sort of empower consumers to make sustainable choices. And so I imagine that Singapore in particular, but I think the region in general, will see a surge in deployment and research and development of some of these areas.
Singapore indeed has been exploring this arena quite extensively. We're even exploring new sources of energy. Nuclear energy, which was once deemed unsuitable, now has been identified as a potential power source by the year 2050. Hydrogen is another form of energy being looked into. So the fact is that Singapore could play a larger role here, right? To what extent do you think we can actually expand our areas of cooperation with other countries in the region, and in which areas, in order to accelerate progress for ASEAN as a whole?
I mean, Singapore has some quite distinctive characteristics when it comes to the energy sector. I mean, it's obviously vulnerable to the impact of climate change because of its nature as a sort of low-lying city-state. It also has relatively limited space to generate a lot of renewable electricity, you know, within its own borders. So it's naturally going to be interested in some of the benefits of an open international system and try to bring in some of the low-carbon electricity or the low-carbon fuels that it's going to need, and also interested in some technologies, perhaps including small modular nuclear reactors that are can deliver electricity and very compactly. So it's no surprise in that sense to see Singapore taking the lead in some of the regional discussions on trade and on some of these new innovative ways in which it can benefit from resource allocations or resource endowments in other parts of the region. So I think you know, that's certainly where we are having a very productive dialogue with Singapore already, is on what about low carbon hydrogen? How quickly can trade in some of those in hydrogen and hydrogen rich fuels really scale up? And I think that's going to be a very important one. But let's not lose sight of the fact that the first solution for energy transitions is still going to be efficiency, is still going to be clean electricity. But there's all sorts of complementary areas where I think Singapore is going to play a hugely important role.
Self-reliance and diversification of energy sources. This is a theme that has become much more prominent since Russia's invasion of Ukraine and, of course, the imposition of sanctions on Russia. The situation has accentuated Europe's heavy reliance on Russia for fossil fuels, and it has prompted countries to accelerate their own efforts towards renewables. How to preempt such scenarios where countries only really spring into action when threatened?
That's a really great question. I mean, of course, as someone working in the area of energy and climate, you know, you like to believe that a climate emergency is enough to motivate countries to act already. But I think what you're seeing in Europe at the moment and in many other countries is that when you have also this really strong energy security motivation, that can actually accelerate change quite dramatically. And what we need to focus on is that, you know, the solutions that we need for that energy security crisis, we need to make sure they're aligned also with environmental imperatives. And we think there's a host of technologies and innovation and investment options that really do sort of hit the mark for all of these major challenges that we face today.
Thank you very much for your time today. Really appreciate it, Tim. Tim Gold is Chief Energy Economist at the International Energy Agency. You stay safe and take care, Tim.
Before acting on the information on Money FM, please consider if it's suitable for your own investment objectives, financial situation, and risk tolerance. To listen to more great interviews, download our podcasts at moneyfm893.sg or download our audio app. That's AWEDIO. Available on Google Play or the App Store.